Today's podcast is a replay of my conversation with the formidable and inspiring Jeff Krasno. I'm choosing to publish a replay today because right now I've put everything on pause just for a moment or two. Over the last few years, I've made my life a bit of a project. I felt the need to work on myself, to make improvements in different areas so that I can be better today than I was yesterday. In doing so, I found some amazing things that lift me up, that light me up, and make me feel like I'm moving forward. Things like doing this podcast and chatting to the amazing and wise people who've been my guests. Things like embracing regular exercise, getting sleep, drinking water, eating healthily, and trying to be the best father and husband I can be, and enjoying other interests such as my reading, caring for my beloved houseplants, and my Japanese maple collection. Along the way, I've also embraced a practice of mindfulness and meditation. I've become an investor in interesting and worthwhile companies, and I've started exploring the richness and texture and the diversity of life. And all of this while also working a full-time job to a backdrop of climate change, pandemic, war, corruption, and a political crisis. There's a lot going on. And sometimes you don't know how maxed out you are and how much the things that liberate you are actually becoming burdensome until something comes along and tips you over the edge. And that is what happened to me recently. I've burned out and become stressed out. So I need a pause, a breather, a mental health break. I'm going back into therapy and I'm slowing down just for now. I'm taking my foot off the gas until I'm better. And then this podcast will resume again. It's been going since 2017 and I've been blessed with some conversations with some of the wisest and most insightful people you could possibly meet, all helping me to discover the secret sauce of being well, doing well and living well. Being, doing and living, the holy trinity of what it means to be human. Anyway, enough of that jibber jabber, let's get on to some more and better jibber jabber as we revisit that amazing conversation with the erudite and inspiring Jeff Krasno. So Jeff, thank you for agreeing to have a conversation with me today. I really appreciate it. And not to kind of waste too much time, but I wanted to start off with a quote from Jiddu Krishnamurti. It's quite well known, but he said it's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. And with everything that's going on at the moment, with there's corruption in politics, there's climate change, there seem to be an awful lot of problems in the world. How do we remain healthy in the face of all of this kind of, difficulty and stress and unpleasantness that's going on right now?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Chris, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. To address that, I mean, it's a conundrum, right?
Yeah.
Because, every minute of every day, it feels like there is fear and outrage hurtling at us, right? It's very hard to maintain an evenness or an equanimity or even process rational thought when we're seem to be incessantly confined to other parts of our brain.
Yeah.
Fear obviously was a feature in the system and not a bug on the Serengeti. Obviously, we're all equipped with a autonomic nervous system that functions well when we are faced with threat or danger. But in our current climate, we seem to be faced with perpetual threat and danger. And we seem to be living in that fight or flight response of our autonomic nervous system within our what's called our sympathetic nervous system, which is through the hypothalamus excreting extensive amounts or incessant amounts of cortisol and keeping us kind of in a state of constant agitation such that we don't seem to be able to have the ability to cooperate flexibly at scale with each other. And for me, as I try to survey to the best ability that I can, the great achievements of humanity, they've all been predicated upon that ability to socially cohere, to cooperate flexibly at scale. That's really what distinguishes humans on some level from any other species. Other species can often cooperate at scale, but not flexibly, or flexibly, but not at scale. We do seem to have kind of in our best moments, the ability to accomplish tremendous things. But, you know, it's like, as I survey even the COVID landscape, in some ways that has shown a microscope on cultures that are more able to cohere and others that are not. So you and I both live in cultures where there is kind of hyper-individualism, capitalism, et cetera, a sanctification of civil liberties and individual freedoms, as there should be, but to the point that we had a very, very difficult time cohering around the COVID crisis. Obviously, we could point our fingers towards leadership or lack of leadership, but I think it's just more constructive to focus on other countries and other cultures that were able to make individual sacrifice in the name of the collective good. And ironically, it's those countries and cultures that in turn received more individual freedom because they were able to focus on collective good. So I think about like Taiwan or New Zealand or Norway, Finland, Denmark, etc., cultures that maybe don't possess that same level of cutthroat, rugged individualism that other Western countries had. And I look at those, you know, I just have a friend that just returned from New Zealand. He's been attending large-scale outdoor concerts there with tens of thousands of people for 8 months with no vaccine, with no dreaded passport. and I'm looking at, you know, trying to witness what's healthy and what's unhealthy about the global ecosystem. And I keep coming back to that place, you know, fear, which cultures seem to be engulfed in fear and by extension, kind of misinformation and weaponized disinformation that's being promulgated on social media, that's sort of creating this sense of polar opposition about every single thing, like from the most banal to the most existential. You know, fear of the virus, fear of the vaccine, fear of climate change, fear of joblessness, fear, you know, it goes on and on. Fear of Black Lives Matter, fear of authoritarianism, fear of civil liberties being infringed upon, fear, you know, there's on either side of every coin, we're just getting pushed and pushed and pushed out to the edges. And, you know, I keep searching for a middle way. But oftentimes, you know, the truth is boring.
Yeah.
And, you know, excavating for it requires thoughtful discourse. It requires a true marketplace of ideas. But that whole John Stuart Mill marketplace of ideas concept has been completely undermined by misinformation. It almost just doesn't even exist anymore. So we're having to adapt, you know, to this new paradigm. And, you know, change is clumsy. And, you know, obviously institutions that have long provided stability, such as government and science and journalism, are provided stability, and with an asterisk, often at the expense of justice and equality, but some stability nonetheless. Those institutions are obviously being highly questioned. And I think that there is a group of people that seems keen upon sort of repairing that leaky ship and believes in reinvesting in the institutions of the Enlightenment, et cetera. And then there seems to be another growing sector or cohort that feels like, nah, just let the ship sink. Yeah. and let's build a new vessel.
I mean,
it's a very trying and uncertain time.
Do you think there is a because of this kind of genetic predisposition towards fear? You know, we've always had something to fear. You know, in the jungle, it was the saber-toothed tiger. In the, you know, 1950s and 60s, it was the Cold War. It's Russia then came, you know, the kind of anti-Islamic wars in the Middle East. And now that these kind of things are starting to get out of the, you know, be dealt with one way or another, do you think there's a kind of vacuum that needs to be filled? So suddenly we're finding conspiracy theories floating around about how Democrats are all, you know, eating children or eating babies and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, we're scared of the vaccine. Like you said, we're scared of the virus. We're scared of everything. And the prize actually goes to those people who can give us something to fear and make some money out of that.
Yeah, well, I think fear has a megaphone with social media. Social media has proven to be a absolutely wonderful tool for organization, but an awful sandbox for thoughtful discourse and reason. And, you know, social media is the way many of us get our information at this juncture. Machine learning and algorithms are so adept at leveraging negativity bias. And so there's almost, I think, been a perfect storm, or one might call an imperfect storm, around COVID, where you have fear and uncertainty and a tremendous amount of isolation. And then you have misinformation, and then you have social media. And that kind of trifecta, that elixir, has proven to be incredibly detrimental to, again, our ability to cohere and find collective good and have thoughtful discourse and, you know, find the best ideas, et cetera. And, you know, a lot of times it's because we are looking for connection, and it is there are neural rewards baked in to the creation and dissemination of misinformation. When we post something on our social media feeds that have no basis in fact or truth, they are 6 times more likely to get some form of engagement, some kind of like or comment, et cetera. And when they do, kind of per the tenets of B.F. Skinner, you know, we are reinforced to repeat that behavior. So, and so we see, you know, I've seen many people kind of in my community, in the wellness community, grow their social media platforms exponentially through the leveraging of misinformation, because it's so intoxicating. You know, we saw, like, you know, you say this notion of Joe Biden's a pedophile, you know, this was all over my social media feed, obviously a claim that has no basis in fact, but then it's almost gamified, where then someone in the comments will then say, well, not only that, but so is Tom Hanks and Oprah, and they were at an underground pizzeria drinking adrenochrome. And in a way, what that then what we have is a kind of the dissemination on an exponential level of fear and misinformation is happening, such that it becomes very, very hard to discern what is the truth. You know, the ground gets so shaky beneath us. I think this is like what we're having to manage. In some ways, you know, it is a mass psychological non-consensual experiment that we're all undergoing with social media. And you know, I have only vague ideas in on how to address it. But it certainly is not something that's subsiding. It's something that is arising. And, you know, I don't know much about the world of deep fakes, but I know just enough to be dangerous. And I think, you know, what we have in front of us is a world where You know, anybody can say anything about anyone, and there is very little plausible deniability. And I think, you know, we're headed into a world where there are true existential threats like climate change, and that there will be mass cultures that do not even believe in the viability of that science.
Do you think that all of this is, I mean, in terms of social media, right, I feel like democracy has always been a slight illusion in terms of, you know, the spoils go to those who can afford the biggest billboards and all that kind of stuff. And social media has just kind of amplified that hugely. You know, whoever controls the message gets to control what people think, how they vote, all that kind of stuff. But do you think it's distorting our sense of reality to such an extent that rather than actually having to develop a kind of coping mechanism, a lot of people are just choosing to escape from it altogether? And you know, there's a possibility that people are escaping into other forms of you know, living, like, you know, especially in the wellness sphere, you know, mindfulness and meditation are huge at the moment. But is that kind of turning our back on this kind of jumbled mess of what is what we kind of loosely call reality these days?
Yeah, well, certainly, if anything is the antidote, it is the dissemination of mindfulness and meditation practices and modalities. You know, anything that can bring us, you know, out of our amygdala and into our prefrontal cortex, into a place of greater insight. I mean, really, meditation is sort of it's almost a clunky phrase or a clunky word. It's really just practice in trying to learn what's true, and an exploration or examination of the nature of the mind, and witnessing the mechanisms and functionality of the mind such that one can greater understand one's own psychology and the psychology of the world. Of course, the final aim is to understand that there is no difference between your psychology and the world. In fact, there is no world. There is no sense of stable self. There is only, eventually at the end of this process, or there is no end of the process either. It is just a process, is the realization of that non-self, of that we, and you can see that this sits behind almost every spiritual tradition, which is something I'm very, very interested in, because I think, you know, for 3,000, 4,000 years, we've been caught into kind of various different religions, and kind of post-Nietzsche or post-God is dead. I'm not really sure he is. He seems, there still seem to be digging that grave. but what I tend to try to examine the world through a lens of ethics and morals, and finding what consilience exists across many of these stories and traditions and heuristics, and sits kind of what sits behind them. I think I heard Christopher Hutchins, I think one of your countrymen, say, you know, once, before Moses held up a stone tablet etched with "Thou shalt not kill," we all had a moral intuition that murder was bad, was right. And so I think we would all be greatly served as a global culture to try to examine what those moral consiliences are, what sits behind all of these different religions that have been used and leveraged in some ways to divide us, and try to establish universal truths and axioms that become a lens through which we can all interrelate and interact, you know, such that we are all working towards the maximization of well-being for the most possible people and the minimization of suffering for the most possible people. Just, that's a very kind of utilitarian notion of morality, but that's the one that I tend to land on. And yeah, these are some of the great challenges I think that we're facing, because increasingly in societies that are underwritten by individualism and capitalism and materialism, there seems to be very, very little room for moral values And this is a bit of a sticking point.
I mean, do you think it's cyclical anyway? I mean, I've heard one argument that this whole kind of this individualism that we're kind of dealing with at the moment, which in a way has led us to kind of staunch consumerism, is actually a byproduct of the hippie movement in the 1960s and 70s, where, you know, it was less about community and being part of the state and the kind of American dream or the Western dream, and more about free love and following your own kind of bliss, if you like, and just standing up for yourself as an individual. And that in turn evolved into where we are today. You know, we have the kind of the peace and love and all of that kind of movement to blame for some of this. Do you think it's just going to evolve back into that kind of free love, free spirit, oneness movement, and then back again, like a kind of yo-yo between peace and love and commercialism?
I mean, I think there are short-term pendulums that we can examine, but if I look at the sort of longer term, I don't even want to call it a trend, but arc, what I see, and this is borrowed admittedly from my friend Charles Eisenstein, but you know, he makes a very strong claim that kind of in the era post-animism, so as the agricultural revolution began to effectuate some 11,000 years ago, you know, we moved from an overall understanding of humans as part of nature, as interconnected with each other, as not separate from the divine, as material objects, not particularly considered separate from the divine. And then, you know, slowly over the period of the last 12,000 years, with the rise of sort of theism, a notion that we have, like, that we each have our own individual soul, and rise of certain Abrahamic religions that, you know, we will eventually, like, that soul will eventually be judged by some divine, imaginary, invisible creator of the world that, you know, with a Merlin's cap that will determine kind of our eternal fate. You know, so, but then that's sort of like the religious expression of this story of separation that then we all began to embrace, this notion that I am a distinct individual, separate from you, Chris, separate from everybody else in the world, separate from nature, separate from God, in competition with you for listeners on my podcast, and, you know, whatever it happens to be, that this story of separation began to take expressions across religion, politics, economics, etc. So capitalism would be a reflection of the story of separation as it pertains to economics. This was this kind of mechanized relationship, supposedly mutual beneficial relationship, that, like, what's good for me economically is good for you. Well, we obviously have learned that that's not true. We've seen now, you know, three Americans own more collective wealth than the bottom 50%. So clearly we've seen this story of separation as it's expressed in economics come into full flourishing or efflorescence here in the United States. But you also see that expressed across other components of our life, whether that's, you know, spiritual, this notion that there is a stable self that's separate, or soul that's separate from everybody else's soul, or political individualism, etc., where all these notions that, like, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, the customer is always right, the voter should be given their voice, you know, all of these continual sanctification of the individual, I think, has informed this moment. And until we have some form of spiritual revolution that can address this story of separation, that can weave a new story of interconnection, I think, you know, we may see, you know, tides, you know, high tides and low tides of individual materialism, but I don't think it's really going to go away until we start to see ourselves as interconnected with each other, the divine, nature, etc.
I mean, we live in a kind of a technological material world, and you know, Russell Brand has tried. You've spoken with Russell about this as well. He's tried to tackle the political world. He's tried to tackle the financial world, and now he's of the opinion that again, a spiritual revolution is the revolution we need, because a political revolution just ends up with more politics, you know, and a commercial revolution just ends up with more commerce, you know. So we need something spiritual. But where does that leave the technology, the material world? How can we balance, you know, being a spiritual being and owning a 42-inch TV with 50 channels and that kind of thing? How do we get that right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Luddite. I believe in conscious technology and compassionate capitalism. I'm not a Marxist in any way, but I think there are models that, again, find a middle way that are able to actually have thoughtful discourse about things like biotechnology, like vaccinology. I mean, biotechnology is a fascinating topic, and to be honest, I know only enough to be dangerous about the topic. But when we approach something like biotechnology, what tends to emerge is that there's folks like Vandana Shiva and you know, Greenpeace and hardcore anti-GMO, anti-biotech, anti-mechanization, anti-corporatism, anti-globalism, you know, anti-anti, all those things that seem firmly entrenched sort of all the way over here. And then there's sort of the technocrat globalist class, you know, Bill Gates seems to be, you know, on that particular throne right now, for better or worse. And there doesn't seem to be any constructive conversation happening in the middle. Like, there, the world that supports genetic engineering has actually plenty of legitimate points to be made. You know, there is something to be said for no-till farming. Now, I know that that is also a tenet of regenerative farming, but that's actually a place of shared agreement. So maybe we start from there. That conventional farming techniques and the Green Revolution and the new Green Revolution, you know, maybe that didn't work in all of its effects. That had deleterious impacts on local farmers. It did address periods of acute famine, though. Yeah. So here we are. Here we are now, cascading towards 10 billion people. You know, we need to have constructive conversations about how we use innovation and technology without just saying, like, oh, well, that's just more of the global corporate elite trying to, you know, scoop in all of the patents or whatever it happens to be. You know, I look at, like, I've read cases about, you know, and again, I know just enough about this to be dangerous, but, like, there has been cases where, you know, genetic engineering has actually had very beneficial impacts. For example, with the papaya in Hawaii, I know that there's an ongoing debate about, you know, golden rice and vitamin A deficiency and beta carotene in the Philippines. So, and of course, I come from a place much more of a regenerative farming bias, and you know, many of my friends are in regenerative farming or creating programs on permaculture, and so that's the place where I kind of most live. But I think, you know, where we can actually make some progress is to actually, you know, pull some of the greater minds around one table and say, you know, hey, listen, you know, it's not really like GMOs clearly are creating a class of they're clearly stripping farmers of their independence to control their own inputs, and they're feeding income inequality at a place that's unsustainable. And there are some things about genetic engineering that could be quite useful if they were leveraged compassionately and properly and intelligently. So these are the conversations that I think, you know, that we need to have. I mean, as it pertains to technology and information, I mean, I posted one thing on Facebook one day, which was, I did some back of the napkin math where I said, you know, if each user on Facebook paid $2, and of course that would need to be graded by the value of your own currency or whatever, but if the average person paid $2, Facebook would maintain its overall revenue levels. Would you pay $2 a month for this service if you knew that there would be no algorithms, that there would be no ads, that there would be no data mining, that there would be no targeting? And almost everyone said yes. Yeah. So I think, you know, what we've, one thing that we must address, and this is not coming from the right or the left, because this, there are, while I don't think there's, well, I think there's an asymmetry between sort of Trumpism and wokeism. There is a shared common problem there, which is that ad revenue driven media is broken. It has misaligned incentives, and it is creating, it's creating what we see is this, in this crazy political and social polarization, where you have outlets on the right that are only going to consistently hammer home messages and videos and sensationalism and hyperbole around issues that target their core demographic that is then leveraged for very specific advertisers. And that is also happening, you know, on the left. And, you know, I look at this awful case of this young boy that was just shot in Minnesota, during 10 miles away from the Derek Chauvin trial. And I mean, it's just so heartbreaking and so heart-wrenching. I mean, this young boy, you know, that but I'm also trying to do my best to look at it with kind of after the snow globe of my emotional mind settles, and really try to understand what happened. And because, you know, it's just going to continue to happen unless we try to understand what are the root causes for travesties and tragedies like that one. Yeah. And obviously, you know, African Americans in the United States are targeted on a daily basis in a way that is disproportional. They're given sort of tickets and pulled over and all these kinds of things in ways that are absolutely unequal and unfair. And that might have contributed to the fact that this boy had had outstanding warrants. And, you know, and so the ground conditions for him being handcuffed were not based in any equity.
Yeah.
At the same time, he resisted arrest. And this is, and tried to get back into his car and escape. And then that led to, again, the police officer, and to the best, and I'm just using the best of my own personal ability to look at the video and actually ascertain what happened. But she essentially panicked, as, you know, and again, this is not to remove any accountability. She's been on the police force for 26 years. She needs to know the difference between her revolver and a taser. But it is clear by that video that she meant to tase him, and she killed him.
Yeah.
And when I think through, when I try to really dispassionately dissect that, right, there's so many different components that are adding into that. But one is that and this is only educated guesswork, but the only reason I can imagine that Dante resisted arrest when he was being handcuffed and tried to get into his car and escape was because he feared that he might be killed by the police. Not because he had, and again, this is a jump, but I don't assume that he had that much to hide. I think that he had seen CNN and social media feeds run George Floyd and over and over and over and over again, to the point that he is living in a fear that may or may not be grounded in true reality. And I think that this is the problem with ad supported media, is that, you know, CNN and outlets on the left will stoke this kind of hysteria around race as a means to make money.
But this is not anything new. I mean, this has been going on for a long time, and you know, people. I mean, it goes back to, I immediately think of the Black Panthers, who was kind of set up as a community protection group, mm-hmm. if you like, but they were soon turned into almost like a terrorist group by the government, who set to, you know, we need an enemy of the state here, so let's, you know, use the Black Panthers, you know, and they look different to your average white guy like you and me, so it's very easy for them to become, you know, to make generalizations about them, just like people who live south of the border, just like people in China who have, you know, created this China virus that is out to get us, you know. And, you know, we see the world in, or we see other people in two dimensions, you know, we see them as being almost like characters in a video game, whereas we see ourselves as complex and, you know, intricate and sensitive individuals with motivations and all this kind of stuff. You know, and it's something that has cropped up a few times in conversations I've had, this kind of notion of sonder, you know, this inability to see other people as being emotional, complex individuals just like you. Mm. And, you know, I think it takes some level of self-awareness to be aware of the influence of culture upon yourself and aware of media upon yourself. You know, and I've walked down the street and I've seen groups of young people and I've felt nervous. Not because of anything they've done, but because of, you know, stereotypes of young people with their hoods up and all this kind of stuff. And that's culture and that's media. But going back to this kind of idea of fear being a kind of evolutionary part of us, if we weren't being fed these kind of algorithmically generated stories on Facebook or on Twitter or whatever it is, would we be interested in Facebook and Twitter at all? You know, would we want to pay the $2? Because clearly there's a hunger for it, because there is this kind of outrage economy. You know, we like to have an enemy to blame our problems on.
Yeah, I of course, it's pure conjecture. Yeah. I think that while we are addicted to the sort of cortisol fueled outrage balloon, if you will, the mix of a number of different metaphors, I think that, you know, we are thirsting for a world with less chaos on some level. Or, you know, we are wanting to be in a place of rest and digest, and so we are, I think that is a state of greater sustainability and contentment. So, you know, and cooperation again. So, you know, whether or not Facebook would exist, I mean, it did seem to exist prior to the introduction of algorithms that seemed to accelerate misinformation. I do think that people do want forums for connection. Like on my own platform, which is called Commune. We have, I guess what I would call a kind of social media replacement platform, which is a community, a digital community that we built kind of on top of this off-the-shelf platform called Mighty Networks. And there's many of these platforms that are starting to come to market now that are offering other kinds of, you know, digital communities, obviously, because I think a lot of people are becoming dissatisfied with Facebook. But we, you know, we don't have the scale in there. We have, I think, 110,000 people, but the communication in there, obviously, because we've curated it as safe and dependable and trustworthy, are the communication in there is extremely vulnerable and long, what I call sometimes long wave. You know, it's like comment threads that are very, very, very long, that are actually have some level of nuance to it. And it's beautiful to watch. Now, of course, it's a container that has that aggregates people with similar or correlated interests. So the community is already set up to thrive because there are people in there that already are interested in the nature of reality and what is consciousness and what's functional medicine and what is meditation and what's yoga and all these kinds of things. So it's almost, it's in some ways it's set up to succeed. So I do think, and so to me, that's almost serves as like a control group over here, that people do seem to have quite an appetite for exchange in a digital environment that, you know, can sometimes be contentious, but it's deeper. And, and, you know, like Facebook, you know, just at this juncture, I think it's just jumped the shark. I just don't feel like it allows for that. So I think, you know, it'd be interesting to see over the coming years if there is any sort of, you know, marketplace for these smaller, more localized, if you will, communities that kind of pop up, you know, a la the Tupperware parties, you know, or book clubs or something, but they're just migrating, you know, migrating online. So, you know, I do feel optimistic about that.
Yeah, I think you've said before that anger is a manifestation of fear, but without the vulnerability. And maybe that this is the problem. It's like, in order to be vulnerable, we need people to be vulnerable with, you know, we need a sympathetic audience. And it can be quite hard to find a sympathetic audience who will be vulnerable with us, you know, and will relate to us and will listen to our kind of deep-seated fear. And, you know, the news that we're fed and the kind of cultural stories that we're fed makes it very hard for people to kind of just say, hang on, I'm a guy, but I'm terrified of, you know, failing, or, you know, terrified of being found out for being weak or whatever it might be. You know, how can we shift people into a safe place?
Yeah, it's almost like we need to train a generation of listeners.
Yeah.
Because and really active listeners, people listening to understand and not necessarily respond. I had a number of very interesting experiences over the course of the past year. I was sort of pressed into writing a weekly column or essay for my Commune platform. And it started kind of in a very naive way. And then all of a sudden I caught myself on top of a barrel, having to produce 2,500 words a week about, you know, some spiritual or political topic. And kind of over the course of that, you know, I addressed almost every significant social topic, from COVID to race to other epidemics that I think COVID has revealed, to obviously misinformation and social media and the election in the United States anyways. And, you know, I will say, if you write 2,500 words and distribute it to 1.2 million people every week, you're bound to find people that disagree with a couple of those words, more than a couple people and more than a couple of words. And I started to attach my personal email to those essays because I was interested in really, you know, trying to foster conversation around difficult and thorny issues. And, you know, I got certainly a lot of incoming adulation, which was nice for the ego, whatever, lovely, and tried to respond to every one of them in some way or another. And then I got plenty of the, of just like Trump 2020, yeah. 19 memes, you know, swarm me with delusion. But then I got a lot of probably like 100 a week of like legitimate, thoughtful criticism, people that actually took the time to, you know, write out like numbers of bullet points or say, well, you know, I don't really believe in your assessment of free will or the absence of free will, and here's why. Or like, I don't think that, you know, you have a place as a white man right now to be commenting and writing about race. Here's why. Da, 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 da. Or, hey, I don't think that, you know, I think that discussing the idea that BMI or obesity is the number one indicator for COVID fatality, which honestly seems to be true. Yeah. But I think that that's, that by doing that, you're shaming people because it's not their fault and it's not behavioral, it's genetic. And here's why, da, 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 da. Anyways, I got myriad responses of people that took issue. And to be honest, I learned a lot because, again, I'm not really an expert in any of these things. I take them quite seriously, but I suppose in the absence of being an expert, I can only frame myself as a thought leader or whatever. So but that's at least my escape clause. And so in the aftermath of these, of receiving these emails, you know, the ones that were particularly thoughtful, I would spend some time responding. And, you know, if there was a thread that kind of continued, I would just give them my phone number. And I was like, all right, well, let's just set up a Zoom, you know, or something. Yeah. And I started to allocate a few hours a day on Monday and Tuesday afternoons for these Zoom calls with people that were essentially ready to excoriate me for something or another. And invariably, like they share, they all of these conversations shared a common element, which is the Zoom call would start. And I, despite my inclinations, would not say anything. And I would generally sit there for 45 minutes without ever saying a word. And oftentimes what I would be in receipt of had nothing to do with the topic that we were arguing about. It was generally that person's biography.
Right.
And sometimes related to the topic at hand. And at the end of this process, after doing it for a number of months, and to be honest, like accumulating quite a significant group of new friends, my takeaway was really just so simple. It's just that people in the end just want to be heard.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. I've heard that before. I've heard, you know, the, I've heard someone say, and it was, I think it was after the backlash against Black Lives Matter. And it was someone very thoughtfully kind of took emotion out of the equation and just said, there seems to be a hunger on both sides of this argument. You know, you've got the Black Lives Matter, you've got the right wing, whatever groups they might be. They both want to be heard. They both want to be recognized and seen. You know, and maybe that's something that we've lost with all of this kind of individualism. We've lost the ability to, we're so focused on ourselves that we've lost track of being able to see other people. Maybe that's it.
Yeah. I mean, and certainly in, you know, there's a tremendous amount of personal inventory to be done on many fronts. And obviously as a white American male, I participated in my own inventory on many occasions, but particularly in the wake of the Reckoning for Social Justice last summer. And boy, I mean, I studied race relations at Columbia University. That was what I focused on. And I learned more over the course of last summer autodidactically than I think I learned at a relatively reputable college here in the United States. So And I also really wanted to take a good amount of time to truly understand Trumpism, because if we don't try to understand it, you know, we're really just in avoidance or denialism. Yeah. And, you know, I in many of the conversations that I had with folks, they were with people kind of on the right. And, you know, more and more as I became to establish relationships with, you know, mostly white rural women in America, you know, like, and you're just listening for hours on end, you know, you windows open up into understanding. And, you know, again, this doesn't remove any accountability that one might have for a particular reprehensible action, but we seem to be judging people not for any particular reprehensible action. We seem to be judging people only for their politics or only for their particular racial identity. And, you know, I mean, I will say that in a lot of these conversations I had, you know, this notion that anyone or any group has a monopoly on privilege is itself a reflection of some privilege. Because as I spoke with like single white women in rural America, like with two kids living in a trailer, holding down two minimum wage jobs at Burger King and Home Depot in a town with no police and no main street, and the only available food is at the Ready Mart or the 7-Eleven. I can guarantee you, Chris, that none of these women felt any sense of privilege.
Yeah.
Even if they enjoyed some level of privilege, if they happened to be pulled over or actually not pulled over on a highway. I mean, I would ask them that and they would say, Jeff, we don't even have police. Yeah. but even though it's fair to ascribe some level of privilege to them in their own lived experience, they don't feel any sense of privilege. And nor do they feel really much sense of guilt by what their great, great, great grandfather might have or might have not done or contributed to. And I think that we really need to be careful with shaming these people. Like, the road to a more equitable society will not be paved with shame. it will come through really trying to have some degree of mutual understanding of each other. And when I look at Trump or Trumpism, you know, obviously many people much smarter than I have commented on this, but I mean, Trump, almost in the absence of judging these people, gave them agency.
Yeah.
And in his own moral vacancy, and I've been clear that I think that this gentleman is dripping with sin. I think he is the distillation of depravity on every level. But at the same time, he became in some ways sort of a like Jesus for people, because he cared for the poor, he didn't judge, and through his own moral vacancy expiated and absolved people of their sins.
Yeah.
So it's a strange way of looking at it, but it's like, until we can kind of understand some of these phenomena, we can't get our arms around it.
I mean, are we just so blinded by our own problems, our own anger and our own fear, that we've just lost the inability to see other people entirely? You know, we've completely dehumanized everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is a tendency. I mean, even in the best of us, I mean, I'm self-involved all the time. You know, I'm like, oh God, when am I going to write this new book? It's all about my new book. Like, you know, I get lost in the chatterbox of the mind and the ego all the time. You know, what are people going to think of me? You know, like judging myself through the eyes of others, like I am what I have, I am what I do, I am my resume, I am my latest column, I am my latest social media post, I am, you know, all these identifications of the ego and thrusting the requirements on the ego of my partner, of you, you know, whatever, all these things. Like it's, you know, the best of us trained with all of the mindfulness tools in the world can, you know, live in this puddle.
Yeah.
You know, that being said, you know, I do, you know, I'm a proponent of mindfulness, and the reason I think it's so powerful is not only that it's such a pragmatic tool, but that it has the capability to spread in a way that doesn't really require you know, an herbicide or a pesticide. All you don't really need anything except your breath, and you have that until you don't have it anymore. So I do feel that this is I think the one of the optimistic things right now, and it's also been a source of frustration, is that this past year that we haven't leveraged it more for conversations about real public health. And I mean, some of us obviously have, and there are many people that are out there talking about meditation and mindfulness. Obviously, like if you look at COVID and who it's really impacted, it's all people that generally are immunocompromised or old. And so really we should be talking not just about vaccinology and immunization, sure, but you know, because we're not probably in the United States, there's probably about 150 million immunocompromised people. We're not going to give them all an organic diet and vitamin D tomorrow. Yeah. But there is a conversation that we could be having right now that says, look, this particular disease had a fatality rate that's pretty low. It had an R naught of maybe 2.5 or 3. The next one could be, you know, 100 times worse, you know. So we need to take this opportunity right now to, yeah, focus on true well-being, focus on bolstering our immune systems, focus on movement, restoration, community, purpose, nutrition, those five pillars that populate wellness, you know. And one of those things for me is obviously, you know, is meditation. Yeah. Because those things almost can't exist without meditation, because meditation moves you into the place where you can have a discerning mind to make those choices that will more enhance your life. It's hard to be, you know, when we're in a state of stress or trauma or, you know, fight or flight, it's hard to make the decision of like, oh, I'm just going to eat a carrot.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. What do? You go to the freezer and you pull out a pint of Ben and Jerry's and you take the whole fucking thing down. And that gives you like minor relief for about 10 minutes and then you're fucked. So, you know, this is why it's so important.
But I mean, near the beginning, you talked about, you know, if we want to seek truth, we have to get quiet and look inwards, because that's where our ultimate truth is. The only thing we can really rely on is what is going on inside. But there has to be some sort of push, because you know, our whole world is based on the idea that the truth is out there,
right?
You know, and it's spirituality is dealt with by the priests in the church. You know, reality is decided by the newspapers and the government, and actually what is in here is secondary to all of that. It's just daydreams and kids stuff, you know. So there needs to be, you know, often people who do look inwards for their truth, and then they discover mindfulness or meditation. Often, unless it's a kind of fashionable trend, often it's come from some sort of place of crisis or some place of, you know, reaching rock bottom and having nowhere else to turn but inwards. You know, how are we going through a collective crisis right now that's going to, you know, push some people in that direction, or do we need to somehow lure people in?
Yeah, I mean, it's a keen and astute point. Chris, certainly we seem addicted to seeking external agents to assuage our own inner deficiencies or our own calls for connection. And those are often obviously expressed in the more typical addictions. And Russell obviously speaks very articulately to this, you know, smack and heroin and yeah. cocaine and alcohol addiction, etc. And then, of course, there's all the more insidious ways that we seek external agents to address our own deficiencies, whether that's consumerism or chocolate cake or social media, you know, the approval of others, codependency, all these things that in some ways are worse because we can limp through life without ever addressing them, you know? Yeah. But we're up against systems and structures that make it quite difficult to look inward. I mean, I live in Los Angeles. I have three daughters. We drive down the Sunset Strips, just down the street. You can't go 10 feet without like looking one way or another to see some image of objectified, perfect beauty, whether that's a woman in a bikini or a man in a Lamborghini. That's a good rhyme, actually. Yeah. see what comes up with these things. But like, and then, you know, to all of those constant messages that are telling you that you're not enough,
yeah,
you know, and then turning around and leveraging that not enoughness to market you trinkets and products and services to assuage that feeling of deficiency, that perceived deficiency. And this is, of course, what we have to wake up from, is that there's no external agent that will ever make you happy. I mean, Siddhartha, if anyone taught us that quite a long time ago, 2,500 years ago, I mean, his message is essentially you open the Amazon box and before you even finish opening it, you're thinking about the next Amazon box, you know, with the next goodie that's going to give you some kind of biochemical rush. You know, that'll last 10 seconds before, you know, your distracted mind is off clawing for something else, right? So, you know, obviously we live in this sort of incessant states of craving, and craving in the broadest sense, you know, and as you say, the key is not looking for external agents to address this sort of discontent, but it's looking inward. Now that sounds a bit mawkish, a little bit glib to some people, sounds a little bit patchouli, incense, yeah. saffron robe, but there is great truth in it. You know, anyone that has been down that road and that path can tell you that in the quiet mind, like that you find your version of God as you understand it in the quiet mind. That's it. There's no other place for it to exist. And in a way, it's an escape from the limit, our spatial limitations, right? Because we're all given, like, you know, eyes and ears and nose and all these things that are very limited, you know, spatially. Like, you know, we can see between a range of ultraviolet and infrared, and we hear between a certain frequency and all this kind of stuff. But when we are in that place of calm and serenity, we tap into part, we get a glimpse of something that exists outside of our ability, our five senses' ability to perceive. And we get a glimpse into what could be in a very impermanent existence. We get a glimpse into what might seem permanent, that what might seem eternal. And this is the amazing thing about silence, is silence is one of the very, very few phenomena that we can experience that is actually infinite. It has no beginning, no end, no location, no form. And so this has become sort of the portal into what eventually becomes a realization of the non-self, at least for me, that's how I understand it. A sense of complete interconnectivity where there is only the world, that I, as an individual person, Jeff Krasno, with this nice flannel, cease to exist as separate from Chris across the pond. So, but you know, these are fleeting glimpses, but they're almost like these peak experiences that as consciousness kind of intersects with personhood, this is kind of where I think the matrix, this is sort of where we live most of the time, is like at this intersection of consciousness and personhood, consciousness, sort of the awareness of transitory phenomena arising and subsiding moment to moment. Like if we're pulling back some of this truth, some of the love, compassion, empathy that we find in that emptiness, bring it back through our consciousness and intersect it with the world of the 10,000 things, our personhood, this kind of story, like the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves that inform a sense of our identity, our narrative experience. Like it's this dance between consciousness and personhood that sort of informs like how we move through the world every day. And that's why it's so important to be spending time in silence every day, because most of our life is spent in that world of personhood, in that world of the 10,000 things of like, oh, is my mic working? I don't really know. Can you hear me? You know, all of these things that we're trying to navigate all the time. And the more we can infuse that, the world of dull care, the world of the 10,000 things, the more we can infuse it with a perfume of consciousness, with a perfume of compassion that's found in the quietude, the more happy we're going to be. And not only the more happy we're going to be, but the more happy that our community, our family, our loved ones, our friends are going to be. So, you know, this is why, like, this is the great motivation to do it.
I mean, Carl Jung, I think it was, he said that below the threshold of consciousness, everything was seething with life. Mm. And I really sometimes get the feeling that up here on the surface with our, you know, with our politics and our printer cartridges and traffic lights, we're only seeing half the picture. There's another half of existence that lies in those quiet moments where, you know, physical boundaries break down and suddenly we, you know, we're in touch with the vibe, you know, the collective vibration of the universe, if you like. I mean, is it just a matter of, Ram Dass said, the best thing you can do for me is work on yourself, and the best thing I can do for you is work on myself. Is it enough? This is a question I've had, a conversation I've had with Trudy Goodman as well. Is it enough to just work on ourselves and to explore that and to do our little bit to change the collective vibration of the universe?
I don't think so. And I think, you know, Buddha gave us a handbook.
Yeah.
It's not so much a religion. Of course, it does have its more curious bits in the canon of it, but at its core it's like, this is why we suffer, we don't have to suffer, this is the way out of suffering, and now once you've worked on yourself, here's an ethical path of good work and good actions that then do infuse your personhood. So for me, I mean, these are the things that every sage and mystic and poet has been prattling on about forever. Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, doesn't really matter. It's like, once we can kind of step behind all of that dogma and work and do the work on oneself such that one can address one's own suffering, that one can become a more loving and compassionate world, then it is, I believe, incumbent upon us to then bring that into the world around us through ethical and good work and action. To be honest, for me, that is the definition of gratitude. It's lovely to sit around and meditate about all the things that you have and all the things that you're given, but true gratitude is the acknowledgement of the gift through your works and actions on this planet. And so, you know, and I also acknowledge that there are probably 2 billion people on the planet right now that don't have their basic needs met. Yeah. And we can avoid a whole Maslow conversation, but that's why it's even more incumbent upon people that are fortunate enough, just by mere chance, to be born in this body, in this culture, with this internet connection, with a house to be in and food that I never really have to worry about, it's even more incumbent upon us to then instantiate the world that our hearts know is possible through good work and good action. So in my mind, it's not enough just to be a compassionate recluse on a hill. I mean, and I will say that there is also a role and a place for living in the ashram. You know, I mean, for me, it's almost like a scientific role. I appreciate the role that, like, you know, this was a debate that happened kind of very much between Plato and on one side and Aristotle and Socrates on the other side, the sort of the active life versus the contemplative life. Like Plato retreated to, you know, his Lyceum and just like mostly out of, you know, potentially out of like the pain of seeing his greatest influence killed for his beliefs. But that, you know, there has been this kind of debate amongst spiritual people for a very long time of whether or not one can justify the contemplative life completely outside of the outside of day-to-day reality, or one really that a philosopher really doesn't have much purpose in life unless they're actively influencing the world around them. Like Nietzsche, for example, was a contemplative, and unfortunately, because of his removal from society, many of his ideas were manipulated for nefarious purposes. Like Hannah Arendt, for example, who came later, refused to be acknowledged as a philosopher. She wanted to be a political theorist because she believed that the world of philosophy was this kind of effete, you know, higher institution, you know, vocation that wasn't really truly connected with the human condition. I tend to fall more in the Socratic world, where it's just like, at least at this time where I am in my life right now, and I have at least a little bit of energy to get up in the morning, I feel like it's incumbent upon us who have these platforms or doing the work like you're doing, to be engaged in society such that we can influence it in a positive manner.
I mean, escaping completely feels very attractive at the moment. I do know people who potentially, you know, would spend 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day in meditation, because it was just such a lovely place to be, and reality was actually quite harsh and difficult to deal with. So there is a sense that we all need to become the leaders that we're looking for, and to find that motivation inside to go out there and spread our message or help people who need help, or just try and show an example to the world.
Yeah, and again, I do think there is utility to spending large amounts of time in meditation. I mean, certainly I do think that people that embark on long-term Vipassana retreats, actually have tremendous respect for them. I'm not sure, I've never done one, so I'm not sure I could ever do it. But I do think that there is really important utility there, because people will bring back certain insight and knowledge from those experiences that can enhance everybody's life. You know, I listen to Sam Harris a lot. He's a big influence on me. He certainly spent big, sizable chunks of his life in Vipassana meditation, and traveling all over the world, very much kind of isolated outside of kind of more of a direct influence. But, you know, then he was able to bring that back and develop, I think, a body of work that has been very important and very influential. So, yes, I do think that there is absolutely, you know, room for that. I just feel like right now, you know, I've held a small grudge. I don't actually hold grudges much. You can ask my wife and she will confirm that. But I have smelled I've held a little bit of a grudge against what I call the old school wellness paradigm, that my well-being is my sacred space. Don't sully it up with your, you know, socioeconomic rants or your sully politics or whatever. And to me, that feels very false and a bit privileged, to be honest. You know, I've always seen these spiritual practices as political in some way. Yeah. You know, if you're talking about yoga as union, as recognizing the collective, if you're talking about meditation as connecting, you know, with Brahman or Nirvana or a realization of the non-self, if you're talking about love thy neighbor, yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter. You can just go through the litany of spiritual traditions and the golden rules and all these kinds of things. These things are very political and social in their nature. So I think to remove that and just become sort of an effete class of green juicing yogis, I mean, it's important. Individual health is important, but in the absence of societal well-being, I just don't think it means anything.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important. And it kind of makes me, I know your time is precious and we've run over, but it just makes me think, maybe to sum it up, that I can't remember where it was. It was a meme I saw perhaps, but just the idea of being happy is, you know, being happy and at peace is a rebellious act. You know, it's to, if we can encourage people to find contentment and to seek it out and find peace among each other, that in itself could be a political act. You know, choosing not to engage in the fight that the other person wants you to engage in, you know, or be manipulated like that.
I absolutely agree. I mean, meeting vitriol with vitriol or darkness with more darkness is seldom a profitable project. And I think that there is also a bridge between what you're talking about, really encouraging people to find contentment and happiness with consciousness and meditation, because you can't be happy in the future, Chris.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Happiness is the providence of this everlasting now. And in some ways, happiness is not even reliant necessarily on what you're doing at any given moment. It is more reliant on the attention of that moment. Where are you putting your attention in that moment? And, you know, to the degree that we can rise above ourselves and become greater witnesses of ourselves, I think that helps us along that path of, you know, like, there's nothing, anger and jealousy and vengeance and negative emotions will inevitably arise and subside in consciousness, you know, from in a transitory fashion. But to the degree that we can sharpen our skills to witness those sensations and emotions for what they are, appearances and disappearances in consciousness, instead of connecting to them, attaching to them, identifying with them, becoming them, and then letting them govern and mediate our life, such that we have an ember in our hand all the time, waiting for someone to throw it at.
And then burning ourselves in the process.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So,
I mean, is it just a matter of taking ownership of our attention? You know, our attention is being pulled over here by, you know, people shouting at us about one issue or another. It's being pulled over there by people trying to sell us things. It's being pulled over here by all the kind of conventions that have gone before us and what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. But taking ownership of our attention and choosing where we place it on ourselves or on society, I mean, perhaps that is the superpower we all need to develop.
Absolutely. And to be honest, and this is a subject for another podcast, as I've started to excavate notions of free will, what I've come to is the nature of attention is perhaps the only bit of free will that we actually have. but it would take me another 90 minutes to unpack that. But it would be a very specific conversation that we could have about it. Because as I've understand, not just from a life sciences perspective, but also from my lived experience converging with the life sciences, that between genetics, determinism, randomness, environment, and a sort of the illusory self, I don't have that much free will left. The window is barely cracked in there. But I do believe that I can have the ability to focus attention as part of an experience of consciousness. And that ability might just be the key to being able to make choice in one's life such that one becomes a prior cause for something better. But this is another realm of discovery for us.
Fantastic. Well, on that note, that I will leave that there. I'm sure you've got a busy day ahead.
I do. I actually have a call in a few minutes with the members of the Grateful Dead. I
don't know. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So, well, that's one I'm going to have to seek out afterwards. But thank you for that. So many different things to take away from that. So I'm going to go away and probably spend another month or two thinking about some of the points we discussed. But I really appreciate your time today. So thank you ever so much for that.
Yeah, Chris, lovely to be with you. I truly appreciate your inquiry into these important topics that are thorny and complicated and nuanced and require time.
So no, they really do.
I appreciate your time, as evidently that's all we have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And I think my mind has been a little bit blown, but I really appreciate it. So enjoy the rest of your day, and thanks again.
Thank you, Chris.
So there you go. That was the amazing Jeff Krasno. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And we will be back soon with some new and amazing guests. And maybe in the meantime, I might run a few replays as well. So stay tuned, and we will see you soon. Cheers.